Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast Connected Cars, Get Security in Your Clutches. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Mark Pitchford. Mark is a technical specialist for LDRA software technology with over 25 years of experience in software development for engineering applications. He has worked in many significant industrial and commercial projects in development and management, both in the UK and internationally. Since 2001, he's worked with the development teams looking to achieve compliant software development in safety and security critical environments, working with standards such as DO-178, IEC-61508, ISO-26262, IIRA, and RAMI 4.0. Mark earned his Bachelor of Science degree at Trent University, Nottingham, and he has been a chartered engineer for over 20 years. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your viewing console. First is the console itself. You'll see a set of windows where you can close, open, move, resize, and maximize to your preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenter in the presenter window, a biography, the presentation slides window, and a Q&A window. There are seven icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking on that icon on the far left will reset your viewing area to a default configuration. The rest of the icons will open and close their corresponding windows. You can hover over your mouse there, and the window will tell you what it does. The handout icon, third from the right, I want to point out, it has the handout with the presentation slides in PDF format, so you can follow along with and download for future reference. Now, the Q&A window allows you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the Ask a Question box and then submit using the Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event while the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help you. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Mark, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, and hello, everyone. First, before I start, let me just say that I have a lot of slides for a relatively small space of time, so I won't be spending a long time on any particular one. But certainly, I would advise you to download the slides and read them in more depth as you see fit. So today's presentation will begin by introducing you to the Swiss cheese model in the context of embedded software. Traditionally associated with accident causation, it can be equally used to model the defense of a connected, safety-critical system against cyber attack. Most of us are familiar with the needs and requirements of the world of functionally safe systems. Standards such as ISO 26262 tell us in considerable detail what to do if we want our systems to be safe, and we can be pretty sure then that it will meet all the objectives. We'll achieve that, job done, tick in the box, safe system forever. This Rover 3500 was built in 1977. If its systems are kept in the same pristine order as the day it was built, then it will remain exactly as safe as it was then. Below it is a 2017 Vauxhall Astra, just chosen at random from current models. Buy any such modern car today and it will clearly be far safer than the Rover could ever have been, and much of that is down to the combination of its sophisticated electronic systems and its connectivity providing sophisticated facilities such as automated crash response. The complete isolation of the Rover naturally makes it more secure than the Vauxhall, but for the Vauxhall to retain its safety advantage, it must also retain a consistent level of security. In 2015, it was reported that Chris Valasek and Charlie Miller managed to hack into Ford and Toyota vehicles and to a certain extent control them. Because this was done by using a diagnostic port, it was not seen as being a big issue because no one has access to that unless they can physically access the car. The Jeep hack illustrated was far more significant because it showed that it was not necessary to physically access a car to compromise its security. That moved the threat from being something no more sinister than a well-aimed pair of wire cutters to something that was remotely scalable to an entire product range. It was clear from Miller and Valasek's report that the implementation of the Jeep was not ideal, but the Tesla hack showed that even the state of the art at the time was not necessarily protection enough. So we've established that a purely secure system is an ongoing battle compared to establishing a purely safe one. And yet there is no doubt that in the modern connected vehicles such as the Astra, a lapse in security has the potential for safety to be compromised. Small wonder then, in many languages, the word for security and safety are the same. Indeed, if security issue presents a potential threat to safety, then it must be dealt with to comply with ISO 26262. Cybersecurity is then a continuously evolving game. Hackers don't stand still just because you've made life difficult, and a multiple-level approach to security makes a great deal of sense. This Swiss cheese model illustrates why. No connected system is ever going to be both useful and absolutely impenetrable. It makes sense to protect it proportionally to the level of the risk involved if it were to be compromised, and that means applying multiple levels of security so that if one fails, others are standing guard. Another way to visualize the interaction of security-related technologies is to consider the multiple components in a single machine, working together to defend the application from cyber attack. That's all very well, you might think, but won't that be somewhat expensive if we're going to actually protect every element of the system to the most the highest possible degree? This house in Kirksville, Sydney, has 24 security cameras, 18 searchlights, and 2 reinforced steel gates. It also has roller shutters and bars on doors and windows. The security system cost about $60,000, and the house itself was worth about $160,000. We could all design our embedded systems using such an approach, but it's not practical. So what is practical? How can we address this problem in a pragmatic way? To answer that question, let's first consider what we mean by an attack surface. An attack surface consists of all paths leading into a particular application, the code that protects the paths that lead into and out of that application, the valuable data that's accessible via those paths, and the code that protects the data itself. Some of those fall parts together, and we have our attack surface. The more sophisticated the automobile becomes, the more extensive the attack surface gets. Imagine yourself reviewing the design from the perspective of an attacker. What will you attack? What are you trying to get to? Such an attack surface represents a significant risk even if it exists in a low or non-critical system, because the availability of the previously benign networks provide a portal to the highest ASIL or most critical systems. In stark terms, just because someone has hacked into a car infotainment system doesn't guarantee that they can't access the brakes. It is therefore important to prevent, as far as is reasonable, the access to safety critical domains from those that are more benign. The paper talks of a physically separate bus, but in practice there are several ways to provide some degree of separation between different domains. One approach is to separate by means of hardware, which is quite a costly solution, more suited to an expensive vehicle such as a Tesla. The Tesla that was hacked was considered state of the art in this regard. In September 2016, it was reported that Keen's White Hat hackers found a vulnerability in the Model S browser, which is based on the open source browser framework WebKit. They used this vulnerability to access the infotainment system, the infotainment lamp system, and eventually the more critical CAN bus and hence the brakes. Another approach to separation is to leverage the virtualization technologies in multi-core processors. To put that into a practical context, consider a heart pacemaker which is required to provide impulses to a patient with an irregular heartbeat. Data relating to the behavior of that heart is shared via the cloud, allowing specialists to detect warning signs of abnormalities even before the patient does. The cloud-surfacing subject in this example may be vulnerable to attack from would-be hackers, but it is important that the hackers cannot gain access to the safe virtual machine, even if the cloud-surfacing subject is compromised. To that end, in this example, the communication between the two virtual machines is tightly controlled. This principle is sound in many ways, and there are several RTOS vendors offering their particular take on it. However, it would be a mistake to think it can offer a defense against all possible cyber attack. Here are some illustrations of how separation kernel hypervisors are proposed for use in the automotive sector. A principle common to each of them is to provide a mechanism to separate the high and low criticality domains. Here is a possible architecture to deploy separation technology to help optimize security. In this instance, we see how a network gateway might be handled. There are five virtual machines shown, and each of these virtual machines is assigned the least privilege it can have in order to achieve its aims. So what would be the point in any secure code in this scenario? Well, there are several potential weak points here. For a start, hypervisor provides access to all the virtual machines. The gateway virtual machine is highly critical. It contains highly critical code. How secure is that code? Similarly, what about the data at rest encryption? The diagram also doesn't really talk about the communication between virtual machines, and that is often necessary. How secure is that mechanism? And what about data endpoints? Can rogue data be injected into the system? To underline that point a little, this year's hack into WhatsApp's encryption application presents a high-profile example of how the best intentions of a security-hardened architecture can be undermined if critical code within it is vulnerable to compromise. Risk analysis will expose elements of the system where efforts need to be focused. For example, consider our inter-virtual machine communications in our theoretical configuration below. Many systems aren't easily categorized. For example, central locking is not generally considered to be a high security or high safety application, but if the car is involved in an accident, then suddenly it's vital that the doors are unlocked. And so the criticality associated with different systems might depend on the circumstances in which those systems are deployed. That means that simply separating them entirely from each other is impractical, and there does need to be communication between them. So how could that communication be implemented? We could emulate standard IP, but that would provide a very convenient bridge between the different virtual machines to any would-be aggressor. We could encrypt data, but perhaps that's a processing overhead we don't need. It could protect the interface through obscurity, use a minimalistic bespoke protocol. But what if there are rogue employees within the organization? Whichever way this is done, it's vital that the code implementing it is secure, because this is one of the weak points of the architecture, and hence it makes sense to focus efforts on ensuring that such applications associated with its architecture are well protected. In other words, then, these separation technologies represent one slice of Swiss cheese in the whole scenario of the automobile system. So if we want to protect there is weak points of our architecture. How can we go about ensuring that the code that protects those elements is as safe and secure as possible? Maximizing the security of application code demands a logical best practice approach to its development. Traceability from requirements to source code and tests is clearly a good idea. It is a mechanism to ensure that all the functional safety and security requirements have been implemented correctly. It is less obvious that having more code than the requirements demand is also a problem. Vulnerabilities in the application code often arise from such as redundant code, which was retained from a part finish but dropped requirement, or maybe from a change of development approach, or a mistake from an algorithm, or even from a more sinister perspective, from code inserted with a deliberate intent for later exploitation. Bidirectional traceability ensures there is code to fulfill all requirements and no more code than that. If you consider a perfect V-model development approach, tracing requirements, design, code and test sounds laborious but achievable. But unhappily, life's not like that. Suppose a client has a new requirement partway through development. What other requirements does that impact? What code does it impact? And does the whole application need to be retested? If not, what does need retesting? The TD Manager tool here, illustrated here, provides those answers and more. In this example, suppose there's been a request to change the functionality specified by the installation and configuration system requirement. The highlighted sections of lower level requirements and the source code show exactly what will require attention as a result. Traditionally, secure applications are written in a relaxed manner, tested by pen and functional testing, and then vulnerabilities exposed as a result of that testing. That conflicts a little with the better approach that we see it in a secure, when the code is secure by design. That implies a systematic development process where code is written in accordance with coding standards, is traceable to requirements, and is tested to demonstrate compliance with those requirements as the development progresses. Reactive tests such as penetration tests still have a place, but their role in this scenario is to confirm that the code is secure and not to find out whether it is. We mentioned coding standards earlier. What are those coding standards? Well, some, like MISRA-C, include provision for both safety and security. Others, like CERT-C, are specifically focused on security, or seek to reduce the use of those parts of the language known to cause insecurity. Code that is complex, difficult to test, maintain, and understand is naturally more likely to include mistakes and vulnerabilities. Automated quality review provides many measures of code clarity, maintainability, and testability, and these can be tuned to suit the application under development. They are generally used as comparators. For example, a complicated algorithm may well require complex code, but if a function is highly complex but performing a simple task, there is potential cause for concern. Then there is structural coverage to consider. It's not generally the most used parts of any system that give rise to safety or security issues. It is normally the exceptional circumstances and the code designed to handle them which cause those issues. And yet they are the parts of the application most likely to be left unexercised during traditional functional testing. It is therefore far better to instrument the code and to ensure that it has all been exercised to a degree commensurate with its criticality. Bidirectional traceability is a key feature of almost all functional safety standards. But the need to respond quickly to new hacks and vulnerabilities of connected systems in the field make the concept useful beyond the traditional notion of software development lifecycle. Traceability between each development stage makes it easy for teams to identify problems and implement solutions faster and more cost-effectively. These linked elements are even more important after product release, preventing a vital competitive advantage in the world of the connected system. Here we revisit our earlier diagram, but now suppose that the requirement change comes as a result of a vulnerability discovered in the field. The Connected Tool Suite provides a support mechanism to help ensure that a response is implemented quickly, efficiently, and effectively. In summary then, a secure system cannot rely on a single architecture or design feature for its security. The system needs to combine best practices available for each part of the system. None is infallible, but if each is the best it can be, then the sum of the parts is likely to prevent an insurmountable hurdle for would-be attackers. Traceability between each development stage makes it easy for teams to identify problems and implement solutions faster and more cost-effectively. These linked elements are even more important after product release, preventing a vital competitive advantage. Concludes the presentation for my slides. Over to Kurt now, who will accept and interpret any of your questions for me.
Great. Yes, thanks. We are now to the Q&A. We encourage you to continue to ask those questions. We have a few good questions coming in. Here's a good one. So there's a question about if Ethernet could be considered as a potential replacement solution to address safety issues that have been encountered with CAN, bus, and LIN protocols. Is Ethernet being considered for anything like that? And could it?
Yeah, there is such a thing I know as automotive Ethernet. It's not particularly part of in my expertise, but I've seen such things presented at conferences. Let's put it like that. Certainly from the perspective of the system as a whole, I think things like secure Ethernet have a part to play, the example of hypervisors, separation kernels, and all the rest of it that I've just been speaking of. All of these technologies have a part to play. None of them are infallible, and that, I suppose, is the point. If they all have a place to work together, but there's no combination of them other than isolation that makes it absolutely secure.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's see here. Unlike our computers, we often leave our cars physically in the hands of others for maintenance. In the context of Spectre and Meltdown, the Intel things that have been in the news and AMD, but yet unknown attacks, isn't anything less than separate and secure hardware significantly more secure?
Yes. I mean, that's obviously called into question to some extent that the whole concept of these separation kernels, particularly because you'll probably remember as part of that presentation I talked about least privilege. Well, if there is a vulnerability that allows everybody to hack into the most critical element of the kernel, into ring zero, then, of course, having least privilege assignments is possibly less useful than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So that does pose a question on on that part of the system, and I suppose that's one for those people to answer. But that said, I think the point of the presentation is that they're not impenetrable, and I don't think they claim to be impenetrable. They are a useful element of defence against attackers, and as is secure code, as are an awful lot of other mechanisms that we could discuss. The other thing to mention there is that, yes, we could have several separate hardware, separate different domains separated completely physically, and of course that would be secure. But there's also accountants hovering in the background, and accountants tend to have some input into these things. And maybe there will be debates to be had as to how secure is secure enough. At what point does a vulnerability become a safety-related vulnerability? So there's a sort of compromises to be made and sensible decisions to be made on that basis.
Okay. Good. So there's a question about infotainment systems. So one, you mentioned kind of ECUs, infotainment systems. What kinds of security considerations do designers need to account for with infotainment systems that connect to mobile phones or devices via Bluetooth or anything else? And perhaps cars are even now downloading applications into the infotainment system.
Yes, indeed.
What do you see in terms of security issues and considerations there?
I think there's two elements to that. One of them is the actual security of the system itself. So the security of the information that's in that head unit. Mm-hmm. So you may, for example, you might have paid for something online. You may have your credit card details in there. You may have lots of contacts with various phone numbers associated with them. And those, if those are accessible via Bluetooth, via some mechanism from the outside world, then that's actually quite difficult to deal with. Perhaps more pertinent to this particular consideration, what we've just been talking about, is the ability to access the more critical elements of the car from via that Bluetooth access. So if I can hack into my head unit via a Bluetooth, can I then get access to, say, the network that houses the brake controls and the steering controller and all the rest of it,
right,
via that point? And it's the control in the interface between those low security, low safety criticality, and high safety critical elements that, from a safety perspective, is most important.
Okay. And are there testing things covered in these automotive standards to deal with, accidental and malicious kinds of behavior when you're connecting a device to an infotainment system, involving, like, just trying to even just blank the dashboard or what have you? I guess this is where the containerization and the virtualization really comes in. Is that true?
That's right, yeah. And that's where the separation of domains is significant. We talked about early on, I feel a bit sorry for Chrysler Jeep, to be honest, or Fiat Chrysler, whatever they are at the moment, because given the amount of publicity they've had over that Jeep, and I don't suppose, there's no suggestion that that was any better or worse, really, than anybody else's implementation,
right,
or at least we don't know whether it was. But certainly one of the things they were making a big point of in that paper was the lack of separation between those domains.
Right.
So the fact that they could access high security domains from low security domains is what led them to be able to put the brakes on. If all they could do was retune your radio, then it would be an inconvenience, but it wouldn't be in the same wouldn't be an issue in the same way.
Yep, exactly. And I guess there's a related question to this. We're kind of running out of time, but might placing VMs into containers and securing the containers help improve the security and safety? I guess that's the premise of hypervisors and things like that. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's a similar kind of premise, and all of those technologies are to be encouraged and applauded.
Right.
With the proviso that they've all got, that there are strong points and weak points to all of them. And it's the argument is that the combination of those different elements with those different strong and weak points provides an impenetrable castle, if you like.
Okay, interesting. How about this question about SAE J3061? How does that fit into these security environments?
Okay, so that's an automotive security standard. It complements it, really, because all the different stages that we're talking about going through with, such as the different development stages, so you do the coding and the coding standards and all those sorts of things, that 3601 adds security into the existing safety considerations proposed by 26262. So, for example, to complement your safety requirements, you'll have security requirements too. Your MISRA checking will take into account, or your standards checking, whatever you choose, will take into account security issues as well as safety issues. So it's actually complementary to it rather than particularly there's no contradiction, I think, is what I'm trying to get to.
I see. Okay. Here's a really good question about penetration testing. How do you evaluate the quality of your penetration testing?
To be honest, that's outside my expertise. What I would say about penetration testing in general is that it's a useful tool to prove that what you have is secure. But if you can design it to be secure rather than hope it's secure, then prove whether it is or it isn't, then even intuitively it feels like a better engineering solution to have designed it to be secure rather than to throw stones at it and see if it breaks.
Right, I see. Okay. How about I can get a MISRA checker with my compiler. Why does LDRA's, what does it do beyond the MISRA checker I might have with the compiler?
Well, actually, it's very much better than nothing. Working, implementing a MISRA checker that you have with your compiler is a good idea. There are also free standards checkers, and they're also considerably better than nothing. The difference is that there is variation in how many and how detailed a take there is on the different rules. Let's take MISRA for the example. So you might find that a compiler's MISRA checker covers, say, I don't know, plucking a number out of my head, say 80% of the rules, and a compiler and a checker like LDRA's might cover 95%. And you might think that for your application, well, that's good enough. It's a lot better than if I didn't do anything. That unfortunately doesn't tell the full tale, because it tends to be, it's obviously human nature that the ones that are easiest to find would be the ones that are common to all tools. So the more sophisticated MISRA checks that involve perhaps understanding the relationships between different files and data in different files are considerably more difficult for a tool to highlight and isolate than the easier ones that are, you know, you can spot on one line. So the problem is that the relatively cheaper and quick fix sort of MISRA checkers tend to be less thorough exactly where you don't want them to be.
Right. Yeah, and is the 5% that you're missing the piece that causes the greatest security risk? So that makes
exactly
a lot of sense.
That. Yeah.
There is a comment about J3061 being a pretty high-level document talking about best practices, but doesn't really have any detailed specs on how to build a secure IVN. Is this where the tools and LDRA and maybe some of the other commercial ecosystem pieces in the auto industry can help?
I think, yeah. I mean, the same's true, actually. Even looking at 26262, it's sort of, I mean, you could almost summarize both of them with the phrase saying, essentially, with a phrase that says, do the best thing, do the right things, which is nice advice, but not necessarily all that useful.
Yeah.
Which has been a bit, maybe a little bit exaggerating to make the point, but I understand the point, yes. But I suppose the point is to use the development practices and the advice that you are given in order to make sure that when you construct that particular application, it is in accordance with the steps that you are being told to take. So it's not telling you how to build anything or how to construct anything. It's telling you how, when you do that, it's giving you a process to follow so that when you do that construction or development, it will be done in a way that is sound.
Right, right. Interesting. In terms of another question that's come in that's a really good thought-provoking one as well is this going to take regulators to regulate security or because it's expensive? And it's, you know, there are a certain class of cars that win on price.
Yes.
You know, will it have to be mandated, or do you think this is just something the industry will take a banner on?
My personal view on that, and this is entirely a personal view, is that it will probably take a lawsuit somewhere for somebody to possibly to lose an awful lot of money through some issue that's arisen through this kind of, through some sort of compromise, for others to then think, well, it's obviously well worth doing this, because if we don't, we could be compromised in the same way.
Right.
I think it's fair to say there were issues in the news quite some time ago, and I think this is very public knowledge, with regards to acceleration in certain vehicles, and that led to an awful lot of big newsworthy lawsuits and expensive compensation claims. Mm-hmm. And that it was after that issue that I think that 26262 became much more widely applied.
Right.
And I suspect you can apply the same logic to the security issues.
Yep. Well, good. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our time slot here for today's eCast. I want to thank Mark for sharing his insights on connected car security. We at Open Systems Media and LDRA want to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing excellent questions today. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download there as MP3s. Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.